Welcome to our second hour of Seeing Beyond today. And you know, I've been promising you that we'd be talking about near-death experiences. My good friend and someone who many of you have connected with over the past years is Jessica Haynes. She had a very dramatic near-death experience, was in a horrific car accident about 20 years ago, and shared her experience at a conference for the International Association for Near-Death Studies. She recommended that this would be a topic that you would be very much interested in, and so today we're going to be talking with Chuck Spedrock. He is a member of the Board of Directors of the International Association for Near-Death Studies. We're going to be talking about the facts of this phenomenon.
This is Skywatch for Tuesday, February 8th.
I am Bonnie Colleen. You are going to love this hour because with us today is Chuck Spedrock, member of the Board of Directors of IANS. It's the International Association for Near-Death Studies. The IANS website can be found at that acronym, www.ians.org. That's IANDS.org. Chuck has served on the IANS board for over 6 years now and has been a member of IANS for 15 years. He's retired from a 40-year career in information technology and has taken a keen extracurricular interest for over 20 years in the field of thanatology, that's the study of death and dying, with a special interest in near-death experiences. I've been waiting a long time for you to be on the program, Chuck. Thank you so much for clearing the decks and being here with us today. Welcome to Seeing Beyond.
Oh, thank you, Bonnie. It's great to be here. And hi to those listeners in the San Francisco area and online.
Well, you know, Chuck, I think you and your topic define the topic or the title of our radio program, which is Seeing Beyond, because that's certainly what people who have had near-death experiences do. I guess the most obvious place to start here is with how you got involved with the topic of near-death experiences. Are you an experiencer? Have you had a near-death experience?
That really brings us right to the crux of the matter. What is a near-death experience? And that's one of the issues I hope we help clarify, at least during the program. I answer that usually by saying, well, yes, I've had elements of one. But it obviously goes a lot deeper than that. But when I first got involved, I actually started, of all places, in a dentist's office in the early 1980s. I guess going to the dentist is always a little like a near-death experience, but with kind regard to our dentists, I really appreciate their skills, but I had an appointment to have some fillings replaced, and I showed up, and the hygienist prepped me, and then the dentist came and gave me some Novocaine, and while he's waiting for the Novocaine to take effect, he starts telling this antidote. The day before, he'd met a salesman in a furniture store who just returned to work after being hospitalized for a heart condition. The salesman related how, while in the hospital, his heart had stopped, and they had to revive him with the paddles. And during that period of time, he had this experience of going into the light, meeting deceased relatives, and then they introduced him to other beings there as also members of the extended family deceased that he had no prior knowledge of. Well, the salesman returned, was resuscitated, recovered, and did the research and found out these identities he uncovered in his experience were real people from his extended family that he had no prior knowledge of. Well, about this point in the dentist's antidote, I happened to look up at the hygienist, and her face was just kind of rigid with fear. You could tell this was something that was not comfortable, you know, for her to hear. And I kind of wanted to reach out and say, well, I think this is a comforting sort of message. But at the time, I didn't know near-death experience. It really wasn't on my horizon. And the dentist finished his work, and she cleaned me up and left, and I just really had, well, what do you do with that information? So that set me up for a few years later, and I was attending a Unity church, and they said, well, we're going to have this man come and talk about his near-death experience. And that reminded me, and I went to hear that man talk, and for 2 hours heard a first-person account. And the only way I think that you really come to grips with appreciating these experiences is hearing first person what somebody experienced. And that's what we do in our groups. We try to get together and have people who can share what happened to them. And you don't need to be near death to have that.
Well, and if you are interested in this topic, maybe you've had a near-death experience, you can find out more at their website. It's www.iandsdavids.org, IANDS.org. It stands for the International Association for Near-Death Studies. Well, you requested that we define our terms here, Chuck. What is a near-death experience?
Well, we are stuck with the label basically because of the precedent set by a book by Raymond Moody in 1975, his book called Life After Life, which is really a classic. It sold over, I think, 23 million copies and been translated in many languages. He gave us the label, but he didn't give us a definition. Dr. Moody was a pioneer. He collected a number of anecdotes and he published characteristics of them, but the pioneer doesn't do the homesteading. So a group of researchers got together, and they're the ones that kind of worked on the field. And probably the easiest way to get a descriptive course of what an experience is to look at the work by Dr. Bruce Grayson. And he developed what we call the Grayson NDE scale. And there's a link on the IANS website to this program, and much of the references I'll be using are listed there. Dr. Grayson's scale has been used for over 20 years now, and people who use that scale to describe their experiences, it's been demonstrated to be valid clinically for understanding the depth of the experience. And what we say, 7 points on that scale is a profound experience. So I guess I'd like to turn it over to say near death, that can be a component, and that's the ones we usually see publicized, but what we're really talking about are these profound experiences. And in the hands of a trained clinician, it's the after effects, how an individual transforms in their life and their understanding, their worldview after having a profound experience that really describes what we have used classically as the term near-death experience.
Well, you know my friend Jessica Haynes. She has actually spoken for your organization. She's been here on the air with me many times over the past 20 years, has described her near-death experience, but very importantly, perhaps most importantly, has described how it's altered her life. And many people have heard Danny and Brinkley at the New Living Expo, for example. He wrote a book called Saved by the Light, and his life changed profoundly after he had not one but two near-death experiences. So there is a kind of a metamorphosis that happens. Is there any way to kind of generalize about this, Chuck, to say people go into a near-death experience this way and come out the other way, or is it just very unique?
Well, it's obviously going to be unique, and one of the things that comes out is that the best tool for seeing how a person's life is affected is to look at when they first start to examine it and what it means to them. Many people don't know what to do with it, are in a life situation where they can't find a way to explore it or anybody to talk about it with. They will suppress it because it's not received well, and the people around them don't want to hear it or whatever, so they're isolated, and the only way to deal with it is to push it aside. And that's really what our passion is to make this awareness available for the caregivers, for the people who might be family members or friends or acquaintances of an experiencer, so that they don't get labeled crazy or they don't get misdiagnosed as some mental pathology.
Well, thank you for that. You know, I've said so many times on this radio program, listeners, you don't have to do it, whatever it happens to be, alone. So you don't have to have a near-death experience alone because you now have an organization and you can connect with them. And again, the website is www.iands.org, stands for International Association for Near-Death Studies. Chuck, tell us about IANS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies. What is the organization's purpose and what does it do?
Okay, well, from its very beginning, this is its 30th year birthday, actually.
Congratulations.
Yeah, it's incredible. And we've just, scratched the surface on this topic. So I think it's going to be around for quite a while. Anyhow, it was founded by some of the key players that got together after Raymond Moody's book created the interest, and a man named John Audette, after reading Raymond's book, instigated getting these people together to meet to form an association. And from the very beginning, they knew they needed to have a way to publish their results of formalized research. And as I indicated before, Dr. Moody's book just sort of defined this arena, but there was no research to support what he had discovered. So that's where they got started. And key players were like Dr. Kenneth Ring, Dr. Bruce Grayson. Dr. Grayson was actually Dr. Moody's supervising professor during his internship. Mm-hmm. And the field of near-death studies, I want to step aside for just a second to say, an incredible acknowledgement to Dr. Grayson's work. And there's a link on the article on our website to Dr. Grayson's a biography. He has published an unprecedented amount of work on this topic, probably numbering over 80 publications, and at least 40 or so of those are research-based, peer-reviewed journal research articles. There's no one that touches that kind of contribution to the field. So those people got together, Dr. Michael Sabom, who was a cardiologist from Atlanta. They formed this association. They started the work. It moved to the University of Connecticut in 1981 and was renamed to IANS, which is formally incorporated now as a 501c3 nonprofit organization. They published a quarterly peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of Near-Death Studies, for 30 years. Dr. Grayson was the editor for 26 years, and recently Dr. Jan Holden from the University of North Texas is our current editor. We publish a quarterly newsletter. We conduct an annual conference pretty much every year. That we've had 20 conferences starting right around 1990, and that's where Jessica went this past year in Denver. This upcoming conference is Labor Day weekend, September 2nd to 4th in Durham, North Carolina, a beautiful fall location, I might add. And it's a membership organization. Greatest source of helping us continue our work is having members.
Well, I'm going to put out that URL again, and we're going to be coming back and talking about the fact that they have groups, local groups who have meetings. So if you've had a near-death experience, if you know someone who's had a near-death experience, if you're interested in NDEs, this could very much be the group for you. So here is that URL again, www.iands.org, stands for International Association for Near-Death Studies. Alrighty, we are back. I find this subject absolutely fascinating, near-death experiences. Our guest is Chuck Svedrock. He has served on the IANS board for over 6 years now. He's been a member of IANS for 15 years. One of his primary functions for IANS is coordinator of local groups. There are approximately 50 IANS groups around the United States, and another 15 groups internationally. So hello to all of you listening on the Internet right now in whatever country you may be. All right, Chuck, it's so good to have you back here with us. So it's always great to go to the Internet, find out information, read stories, you know, find out what might be our next step. But boy, when we can come into contact with people of like minds and beliefs and experiences, it makes all the difference. I think community is so important, especially when we're out there on, I guess what I might call, the leading edge. So talk about the local group meetings that you have.
Okay, Bonnie. Thank you. First of all, groups in the U.S. and everywhere are come in all sizes, and they change, and they have variable formats. I mean, we have groups that have met in people's living rooms, all the way up to large incorporated groups who have their own 501c3. The longest standing group has been in Seattle, Washington now. The area where you're broadcasting from, San Francisco, is actually the most popular location for Ion's groups. There's about five in the area there, Marin County, East Bay, Berkeley, South Bay, San Jose, El Cerrito, and Stockton. So those folks can have a pretty easy time finding a group. The two formats, one is a discussion and sharing group, like a peer support group where people get together and share their experiences. And I always advocate first person. We're not there to proselytize or change people's belief systems. We have, actually, IONS has a policy of no party line on the interpretation of these experiences, and we welcome all respectful points of view. Proselytizing is just not welcome. You can go to the website, see if there's a group near you. The larger groups will bring in speakers. Some groups will have both kinds of formats. So it's kind of like if you're interested in going hearing someone, people like Daniel Brinkley or Jessica Haynes will come to that group and have a presentation and then followed by question, answer, discussion time. And often they'll be selling a book or something like that. So size and format are options.
Well, and your big conference in September in North Carolina sounds absolutely fascinating. Anything else you'd like to say about that?
Well, I've had the unique experience of listening to probably more presentations of IONS conferences than anyone else because I converted the recordings that used to be on cassette tapes to digital format. So I think it's something over 310 or whatever. And you hear, there's nothing like hearing those first-person presentations, getting the latest reports from the researchers, or having various compatible areas, like there's been a lot of interest in after-death communications.
A couple of years ago, I had a doctor on my program, one of my favorite interviews, and his name was Dr. Alan Hamilton. He wrote a book called The Scalpel and The Soul, a fascinating book. I could not put it down. Anyway, he's now retired from medicine, but was actually, I think he's doing some consulting in medicine right now, retired from operating. But he, you know, he was a neurosurgeon who did operations on people's brains, for heaven's sakes. And he wrote this book that was one story after another. And here he was, a clinician. He was scientific. You know, he had been trained that you got to prove it. And so he started out being a neurologist and a neurosurgeon, and he started seeing things and hearing things and having people having near-death experiences and that sort of thing. So by the end of his career, he was a true believer. I think that is so fascinating. So again, the book is called The Scalpel and the Soul. I highly recommend it. Well, talk about the near-death experience. Isn't the idea of that pretty well established in people's minds? I mean, the subject seems to occur regularly in media references from feature films like Hereafter to articles on people's experiences reported in regular formal news coverage sources, including TV, radio, newspapers, and magazines. And of course, each of those has an internet or online outlet. So isn't this getting more, isn't this subject getting out there more?
Well, this goes back to the label problem we discussed earlier. There was an article on Fox News recently about one of their reporters, Greg Palk, who was in Egypt covering the uprising there. And it reports him as describing three near-death experiences, and what they turned out to be were three close calls. And so if it was measured, if he took that grace and scale analysis of his experiences, it would not be what we call a profound experience. It didn't have spiritual or transcendent components, and it might take a little while to see if his life is transformed in terms of his outlook. So misuse of the term is still out there, and that's where the work really is for us to clarify that, especially so that somebody who wakes up in the operating or after an operation or has an accident or something where one of these experiences is induced, that the people who first are there for them will be aware of the possibility of this experience and not be judgmental or dismissive or not helping them understand they've had a profound experience.
And so many times I think it's explained away as being just the effects of the anesthetic, for example.
The problem is the traditional medical model and a lot of the science out there wants to start with a matter-based worldview. And if that's the way you've been trained, you tend to promulgate that in your thinking and in your outlook. And so to transform that, it's not easy. And so the only way is education and hearing these experiences. One of the research is very interesting is that, published in our journal, is that people who listen to near-death experiences accounts are actually transformed and have after effects similar to the experiencers themselves. Mm. And the biggest thing, obviously, is this question of fear of death. Once that is removed, people can live life more fully, and that's really a grand goal for all of us, to eliminate fear.
Have any of the people with whom you have dealt or who've told their stories, do any of them say that we come back again? Do any of them get visions of reincarnation?
Well, that's kind of beyond the scope of my what I wanted to talk about, because the theories on that are really quite extensive. And Dr. Ian Stevenson, another colleague of Bruce Grayson, researched that. Little children that have memories that seem to be of someone that lived and died and then can be corroborated.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to refute that from just a examination point of view. That's a cosmic reality kind of question, and I think there's a larger context. We tend to be human-centered in our interpretations of experiences. Anthropomorphic, human beings being the center. I don't really believe that when you get into the identity question, that Chuck Swedrock, you know, existed in some prior life and now he will exist again in another life. I mean, there's personality that's going to be different. There's identity factors which are different, relationships which are different. So I don't know what that means to say live again. I think what we do know is that there's a context from the near-death experience that says at the point when we would consider them having died, their consciousness is consistent with what it was before that death, and that the transition is very gradual. It's not abrupt in the sense that they still feel to be themselves from a self-perception point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them don't even perceive that they've died in the sense that they will see their body and discount that as being somehow related to them because they're not ready to accept that they've moved into a different state of reality.
When they're in this different state of reality, Chuck, have any of them reported seeing their bodies in that state of reality? I mean, I realize that they are a living consciousness. It is the consciousness they had when they were in the physical body, but when they're wherever they are, we'll call it the other side for the sake of this conversation, when they're there, do they have a body, and is it the body they had here?
Well, the veridical perception component, which is my principal criteria for understanding that the consciousness is separated from the physical body and is not a brain function, that says that a person might perceive the physical matter that is referred to as their body. An experiencer we just had here talked to our local group, Reverend Howard Storm, was so, he was an atheist. He was so much traditional science-oriented that people who believed in this kind of thing were just fools or, you know, soft-hearted or whatever. Religion was totally discounted in his worldview. At that initial point of being out of his body, he couldn't believe that somebody had been placed in his body in his bed in place of him. So he discounted the idea that it was his body. He went so far as to think for a while that they'd actually created a wax impression of him that has his features, and he couldn't believe that they would have done that. It seemed like a macabre joke to him at that point because he was outside of that physical matter. He felt like he had his complete body with him. It was physical senses were present, smelling, seeing, hearing. And the frustrations began when he tried to communicate to his wife in the room and his bedmate, and they wouldn't acknowledge his presence. So it was a gradual transformation to realize his consciousness has moved to a different orientation.
Well, what an hour we've got today with Chuck Fedrock. And again, we're talking about near-death experiences. Well, hearing you call them experiencers. I like that term. So hearing experiencer accounts like you have so many, it seems obvious, Chuck, that they are largely unique in terms of the details or storyline, each one very different. Doesn't that favor an interpretation that these are more like exceptionally vivid dreams than an actual voyage to an alternative reality?
Bonnie, I probably should have said a while ago, that's pronounced Swede Rock.
Swede Rock, thank you.
Yeah. All right, thanks. Well, experiencers, the profound experiencers, would tell us that this waking reality is more like a dream than what happened to them in their experience. I think it's good to reiterate, the definition of these experiences would be using the Grayson scale. It's a clinical approach, so how deep was it in terms of those types of elements, and the after effects. As a matter of fact, it is really quite difficult for anyone to fake a near-death experience or a profound experience because the after effects are dramatic. It's really, while those kinds of things can happen from dreams, I'm not saying that we couldn't have veridical perception from a dream element, that kind of thing has happened, but typically, those kinds of dreams don't produce the after effects or don't rate a profound scale on these experiencers on the Grayson NDE scale.
This is all so fascinating. Can you give us an example? I mean, you've heard so many of these experiencer accounts of their near-death experiences. Can you give us an example of someone who's had that kind of a profound life change once they've returned?
Well, the easiest one is the man I was just mentioning, Reverend Howard Storm. He was an atheist, and pretty much the researchers will tell you atheists change their worldview. They might not necessarily become theists, but they believe there's something after. They no longer feel that death is, turning a switch and there's no more consciousness. Reverend Howard Storm, as an atheist, had this transformation where he went from being a bully, really, somebody who discounted this totally, to becoming a minister in a United Church of Christ congregational church. Now, many experiencers, after their experience, will leave their religions because those are too confining, and they want to express their spirituality in a more open way than might be found in their local church. Others find going to a religious context helps them deal with their experience. So it's really unique.
Well, that's one of the themes that keeps coming through, Chuck, is the fact that these experiences are as unique as the people who are having them, and that just makes sense to me. Now, at least the treatment of experiencers has improved because of all the work of organizations, and thank goodness for them, like IEMS, and the research you mentioned. I mean, isn't that true?
Well, I'd like to say, certainly it's improved. I mean, obviously, there's a wider knowledge of this. But in the latest edition of our journal, there was an article or a research submission from Cheryl Fracasso, I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, and the team of researchers that studied psychologists, the knowledge of psychologists and their attitudes about near-death experiences in terms of the change over time. There had been an initial study in the 1980s, I think 1989, and now they just did a recent study to see how their attitudes might have shifted and their beliefs about this question of a transpersonal reality. And what they found was, unfortunately, and this was, now there are problems with, you know, a random sample and the people that choose to respond, but this was a licensed psychologist, practicing psychologist in the state of Washington, and there was not a significant difference in that first study in 1989 to the one that was just published last year.
And the findings of that study are?
It's published in our journal, the Journal of Near-Death Studies. Cheryl Fracasso, Harris Friedman, and M. Scott Young.
So what you're saying is that psychologists are just as likely to hear a story from an experiencer of the near-death experience and maybe label them as having had a psychotic episode or some other kind of mental pathology?
Unfortunately, that is still too often true, and that's why our work is really so important.
Oh, it is. I can't imagine anything worse than having this kind of... I mean, I would call a near-death experience like having a mystical experience, and I've had two of those. And I'll tell you, it's very difficult to, I mean, I can put it into words, I can tell the story of it, but the only way that somebody else can feel it is if they have it themselves. I mean, they get the storyline, but they don't get the emotion behind it usually, or the transformation that I had because of it. They don't get the feeling around that, even though many of my own family, for example, says I'm not even the same person that I used to be. So it must just be heartbreaking to have had this profound, spiritual, mystical experience and have it poo-pooed.
Yeah, that's my passion. I remember giving a talk in a library one time. I think there were like 80 people. Showed a video and answering questions, and a woman came up to me afterwards and, you know, just kind of off to the side, just, you know, I think that happened to me. And so we went across the street to a coffee shop, and for 2 hours, for the first time, she could unburden this thing which had been, you know, inside and no one to share it with. And that's really what keeps me driving to make this work go forward.
Well, when I was 10 years old, I was either 9 or 10 years old, I had an experience of being two people at once. In other words, I feel like it was a past life bleed through. And I was in a different place, in a different body, having a very painful experience while I was also a little girl driving in the back seat of a car. And I'm telling you, Chuck, it wasn't until I was 40 years old. Now, that happened when I was 9. It wasn't until I got into metaphysics and I was 40 years old that I dared to share that story with anyone. I was away visiting my grandmother and my aunts when this happened, and I was going back home, and about a week later, and I realized that I needed to button it up, never tell anyone, not even my own mother. And I'm telling you, Chuck, as a 9-year-old girl, I could see I don't know how I got this, but I saw people in white coats coming to my house and taking me away. And so I learned at 9 years of age to just button it up, not say a word, keep it all to yourself, and until you are ready, you have the self-esteem, the confidence, and some kind of a background knowledge that will support it to come out. And so it seems to me that this is a similar thing that some near-death experiencers have. They just have to, like you say, sometimes they have to button it down so far that they can't even remember it.
A heart-touching story that I love is from our journal in 2004. It was by a social worker who found a quadriplegic teenager that could only communicate with yes-no signals. And the title of the article is Silent Journey, The Discovery of the Near-Death Experience of a Nonverbal Adolescent. Anyone reading that will, because the social worker had no background in this, to identify that this boy had a medical incident at the age of 8, and then cannot communicate about it. First of all, he doesn't have the language as an 8-year-old. and then had no audience. And this social worker just stumbled onto it and then actually elucidated the experience through a yes-no languaging. At least that social worker was open enough to go find out more information, and then it brought him to the knowledge of saying, I have to just let this boy discover what this meant to him. And it really had a wonderful resolution, too, in terms of the boy taking greater control of his own life at that point.
Well, and I've said so many times on the air, please, people, if you're a parent or a grandparent, an aunt or an uncle, a teacher, a neighbor of children, listen to them. Do not discount what they tell you. Please listen to them with curiosity and with heart and with validation. All right, well, our guest is Chuck Swedrock. We're going to be coming back and talking more about near-death experiences. I find this absolutely fascinating. Again, thank you to Jessica Haynes, a good friend of so many of us, for bringing Chuck to us today, for recommending him. If you want to find out more about near-death experiences, go to their website, which is an acronym for International Association for Near-Death Studies. It's IANDS.org. And find out even where you might attend a local group. Our guest this hour is Chuck Swedrock, and one of his primary functions for the International Association for Near-Death Studies is that he is the coordinator for local groups. There are approximately 50 IANS groups around the United States, another 15 groups internationally. IANS groups are organized by local individuals and are intended to provide a safe place for people to gather to share experiences in an atmosphere of mutual respect and trust. IANS groups are open to the public, and find out more on their website, IANDS.org, IANDS.org. Chuck, boy, I'll tell you, there's just so much to discuss here. What do you make of all this? I mean, after 20 years of exploring the near-death and similar phenomena, plus your own personal extraordinary experiences, what is your perspective, or how has it changed in terms of the questions of human origin, for example, or the purpose of life? Or even, is there an afterlife?
My personal perspective is the highest attainment in life, some call it enlightenment. Enlightenment I would define as contentment. And by that I don't mean I'm content with the conditions of the world and that things can't be made better. I mean that I'm content with my past and how I've gotten to the point where I am. I see all my experiences as contributing in a positive way. You know, some of them were negative, it may be choices I made, but I can see how that can be used in a positive way. And that really comes from understanding what a near-death experiencer talks about when they talk about a life review. You see everything you've done through the eyes of others, and you learn from it. You grow. One near-death experiencer said, he was in the lap of God. That's what he gave the being he was with as a title. And he said he was having a life review, and he saw what he did to hurt, tease another classmate because of her physical issues. And he felt embarrassed, and he said, oh, that's bad. And the response was from this being was, that's neither good nor bad, but a lesson to be learned. So that kind of contentment that can be resolved brings us to where we're at, and we're not stuck in the past. The other thing that I use is this whole field gives me such a strong belief in things being right, perfect, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't worry about the future. It allows me to be in the moment. I love Eckhart Tolle and that power of now kind of mentality, that if I can be in the moment, then I can be inspired with what's available to me right in front of me, that opportunity. And I'm not worried then about trying to defend this or anything, but just living my life to the best I can.
And it seems to dispel that fear that so many people here, especially in the West, have about death. Well, Chuck, what about quantum mechanics and all the attention being given in theoretical physics to the role of the observer or consciousness? I mean, does that contribute to understanding these transformative spiritual experiences?
Given the time we have left, I'd rather not go into that. I really want to look at another question on the subject of ions and something I missed earlier.
Okay.
If I could.
Sure.
Go back to what we can do to help experiencers. And there was an article in our journal from 2004 called Introducing Near-Death Research Findings into Psychotherapy by Dr. John McDonough. And what in that article is dealing with patients who have suicidal tendencies and ideas. And by showing them or exposing them to near-death experience or profound experience accounts, he was able to successfully transform or reduce their suicidal ideation. I mean, that's another important topic that confronts a lot of people, the question of suicide. And so how do these experiencers help us, help people who have either someone they know has committed suicide or they themselves may be considering it. So that's another outlook.
So I'm confused here, Chuck. How would knowing about near-death experiences, how would that prevent somebody from committing suicide?
Well, many experiencers come back and they talk about being sent back and they wanted to stay wherever that realm was, the other side as you called it.
Right.
And it's so attractive to them, they consider the idea of, well, just take my own life, my physical life, and go back there. But they know that we're here for a purpose. And the purpose is the experiences as we're having them, and the experience of life here in the physical domain. That actually, if you talk about my worldview, it's that this was all set up for the purpose of inhabiting a body and having this experience of being human. Often looked at from the point of view of if there wasn't ignorance, there'd be no discovery. If we always knew what was around the corner, it'd be like, oh, home, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
So this experience of being human, one near-death experiencer said as a lesson they had from their experience, embrace the mystery.
Mm.
We're here for that purpose of discovery, of feeling what it's like to be in this situation and learning about relating to one another. I mean, many experiencers really say the point of being here is not about the money we make or the career advancements or other things that we thought were important in a materialist paradigm. It's about our relationships. And that's really the emphasis I think we should come back to all the time.
Well, you have really just, I think, piqued so many people's interest here, their curiosity. What would you say is the next step for a Seeing Beyond listener who perhaps hasn't had a near-death experience but who's very interested in this topic as, say, a pathway to their own for their own spiritual growth?
Research says if you can be around the people who will say they've been dead and come back or have had profound experiences, you will pick up the same kind of after effects, that you will be influenced. Reduction in fear of death, we've published articles on that. So just being around it, go to an IONS group or a similar group, groups like the Forever Family Foundation. I think that's a great way. Now, in terms of helping us, helping IONS, I would just say we're a membership organization. The most fundamental thing we survive on is memberships and attendance at our conferences. And if you go be a member, you will get materials from us that will help expose you to this subject in a wide, panoramic way. The research, we publish experiences all the time. Members get an email of the month with the latest. We call it NDE of the month. I'd like them to change that title, but that's what it comes out as. And the quarterly newsletter, the professional members can join our professional directory. One of the things that is so difficult to find people who or understand this well enough for us to refer, you know, an experiencer to someone. So on our website, there's a professional directory, and professionals can join and establish their qualifications and their interests. They can network with other professionals.
So the important thing here that I'm hearing, Chuck, of many important things, but one of them is that a Seeing Beyond listener does not have to have had a near-death experience to become a member of IANS. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. Our groups are 75%, quote, non-experiencers. Now, in my group, I say everybody's an experiencer. You become aware of it when you are around other profound experiencers.
Well, Chuck Swedrock, thank you so much for having been here. I'm going to get right onto the internet and email my friend Jessica Haynes and tell her thank you so much for referring you. This is one of my most fascinating programs. And if you want to know more about the International Association for Near-Death Studies and even their local groups, go to their website, IANDS.org. That's IANDS.org. Hey, we'll be back here again tomorrow. That's Wednesday, February 9th. We'll be here from 8 to 10. Hope you can join us as we'll continue to see beyond.